Hi, Internet. Welcome to Unboxing Story. I'm gonna Trojan horse a pitch to Melissa of the new slogan.
We have a new slogan?
Because I felt like explore. One thing you'll learn about writing is that you can't be passive or have things that you don't know what they mean when you first hear them. But it's good to have a visceral, like, descriptor of what you do. So before it was exploring narrative from the fringes, but exploring. Like, all credit to my alma mater of LaSalle, because they have, that's like their core marketing, like, strategy, is talking about exploring, because LaSalle was an explorer. But I feel like it was a little dry. So I was thinking it could be unpacking our feels about fringe fiction. Because...
So we went from...
Because things.
A phrase I kind of understood to one... That I really don't get, because it sounds like somebody 10 years younger than me.
Uh-huh.
Slang.
Yes.
Which, to be fair, he is 10 years younger than me, so whatever.
Yeah.
But, sure.
It's our personal 10-year challenge. But, I mean, part of that general racial divide, I think, kind of figures into this podcast, because we're going to talk about a new type of noir film, and I call it neon noir, because Nicholas Winding Refn is the director of this. He directed a movie recently called Neon Demon, and it seems like there's this new kind of infusion of 80s references things to this, like, postmodern version of the hero that, like, doesn't fit with the old classic noir thing, but it has all of these nostalgia 80s things, and I think even 80s films were much more, like, optimistic than stuff that that's made nowadays.
This is true.
So yeah, we're going to talk about first what makes a noir film to you. I know you like, what's it, Gaslight. I never really watched Maltese Falcon, but I know Dad watched it all the time.
I wonder if Casablanca counts. Another big one is The Big Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch that I'm suddenly not able to call to mind. There were some terrible ones that I wish I could forget, involving Charlton Heston playing a Mexican, which was rather sad. Other things like that. But generally, it is the hero is not noble, necessarily.
Uh-huh.
He is usually a hardened, jaded person,
mm-hmm,
who's, you know, seen enough stuff to know that you don't get by just being the innocent person.
Mm-hmm.
So they're usually not afraid to be violent if they have to be. Mm-hmm. Usually a detective, but not always. Sometimes they're jaded cops or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own internal code of morality, but it's, mm-hmm, not as black and white or as pristine as, you know, like a traditional hero.
Mm-hmm.
There are usually femme fatale characters who are also kind of jaded and been around the block and know how to manipulate the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
There are crime bosses, and you're like in the seedy side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't tend to end. It's not that they don't end happily,
mm-hmm,
but they don't exactly. They have a satisfying ending, but they're, mm-hmm, not like an uplifting ending. It's, mm-hmm, like,
yeah, we've been talking about that recently. There's this ending where it's obviously not happy, but there is some kind of catharsis.
Right.
And sometimes, like, in these stories, there's the revenge plot.
Right.
And so, like, if somebody dies horribly, it's like, well, if they did something to deserve that, then there's this feeling of completion, like, the story ending that way. But, yeah, my background in it comes from comics, mainly. And I know from the fact that in the 50s, a lot of comics were starting to get censored, that there was this interesting, like, dichotomy of, like, people writing these heroic characters and this like yearning for like young guys to see this person who is kind of like rough and masculine and doing all these like things, you know, that all the things that Jordan Peterson talks about. But like they're told like get off your skateboard. Like there's this like kind of this institution and a lot of censors that were trying to make it like, well, you can't show kids somebody getting shot, so have it be like, you know, like Batman has rubber bullets, that type of thing. And so the crime genre was changing during the 50s and like the 40s and 50s to include characters that were kind of like, you know, morally gray.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is that in the recent years, there's really only been like Sin City comes to my mind. And so that had a lot of interesting visual tics of like everything's black and white, but then there's some spot colors that are thrown into it in the comic and in the movies. There have been some, like, it seems like one term that's being thrown around a lot with the crime genre is hyperviolence. Mm-hmm. And this idea of, you know, people in recent years, as long as it's rated R, are willing to see somebody get their like head shot off or something like that, because kind of the idea like with like the nice guys is a good example. These are two like in one sense it's a comedy because these two guys the one is kind of like this drunk that's stumbling his way into this murder case, and the other is this guy, this like private eye that more falls in line with the traditional like detective who you know, is like you said, is jaded and everything. But a lot of the violence in it has weight, and like when something happens, unlike in a superhero movie, which is funny that those two things seem to kind of diverge.
Or other action movies in general.
Yeah, there's this kind of idea of like, oh, you know, in this world, the drama comes from this suspense. And you build suspense to the point of some kind of release in the scene of somebody usually getting shot. And it has, I think, because of the focus in these films on building this suspense, there's more of that's, I think, what I tend to gravitate towards in it, and why, like, you know, I feel it's kind of unique to that genre. And so this, the movie that we're kind of using to talk about some of the new blood in the noir genre is Drive. It's kind of, it seems to me to be a, like, a benchmark for like this now is in the cult classic type thing. Like, you're not going to hear everybody talk about it, but if you're a crime movie lover, you know, you have to see it, and that seems to be kind of the idea to it. But whenever I saw it, it always kind of seemed to me to be like kind of like, it takes itself very seriously, and there are still, to me, very pulpy aspects of it that it's funny to me that, like, in something like Sin City, there seems to be this, like, self-awareness to it, and you can laugh at some of the things that are so cliche about it. But with this, like, he wears, like, Mom laughed a couple times because there are certain elements to it, like the scorpion jacket and stuff, that's just so, like to take itself that seriously and have
that still in that, there,
you know, be in there.
Like, I couldn't decide if it was trying to be symbolically artsy that way, mm-hmm. or not.
Yeah, that's that's pretty much what Nicholas Winding Refn does. Okay. It's symbolic, weird things that he takes seriously that other films might. Like there was a, that there seems to be a lot in the indie film space of these films that make references to old nostalgic ideas, but put kind of a new spin on it. And this seems to be one of those ones that actually has pierced the like public conversation that like, you know, it seems like nobody in the film critic space is really that critical of, but coming at it from somebody that hasn't watched a lot of crime films, there are some things that kind of poke. So I'm going to go through some of the beats of the movie. So some spoiler alerts, but obviously if you want to watch it right now, it's free on IMDb Free Dive.
My new favorite streaming service.
Yeah, because it's interesting because it's a lot of drama films, and it seems that they're kind of trying to market it as like this is like serious film service, like rather than Hulu just streaming like Parks and Whatever. Recreation and yeah. stuff. Like you can actually watch some like serious dramas and like intense action and stuff like that. Yeah, so if you want to go watch that for free on whatever streaming device you have, feel free to do that. But we're going to kind of break this down. So it starts out with this phone call, and you get like the basic ideas, like you have me for 5 minutes, and if anything happens in that 5 minutes, I'm yours. And there's that kind of like interesting, this thing that ritual, like this person is, this person is dependable. Like
he's, I wouldn't call it dependable. It's ritualized. It's, very cold and calculating and what's the word I'm looking for? Ritual is not necessarily the best word, but like it's almost OCD level.
Mm.
This is exactly what it is. And this is only what it is. And you got nothing else.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting interpretation. Cause watching it, it was like, I know the kind of basic premise of this before going in, that eventually he's going to meet this girl. So I was kind of seeing it as what I think turns out to be the like what I will give the film that it is self-aware of is like, is this really the type of like, this guy is a hero, but is he a good man? And like, it does kind of deal with those things rather than just make him look like this idealized guy that any woman would be lucky to have. It does make different questions about him, and it's an interesting character study in that way. But I felt like it's kind of, I'm wondering where the save the cat moment is going to be. And, immediately I was like, at least this guy seems like he's competent. And when you start introducing other characters that are incompetent,
yeah, well, that is
you definitely are just competent. Like, I'm rooting for this guy over these people.
But because he's trying to keep his distance from the crime stuff. I think it's like, you have me for this much minutes. This is all I do. I will not help you otherwise.
Right.
Like I am, it's almost interesting. Like he's trying to be part of, he's part of the criminal world, but he's trying not to be a criminal himself. Almost. Right. He's like, all I do is drive you. That's it.
Right. And yeah. And I think that the movie is, I think, asking you to think, you know, is he, like a lot of like what you were talking about with Stranger Things, like you liked that the, characters were acting intelligently and, it helps you to get over a lot of the more fantastical things that could distract you from this kind of realistic situation. So, the fact that he is like he has this kind of set up thing means that despite him being a part of this criminal underworld, you're willing to go along with him on this. I was going to say ride.
Yeah, well.
Horrible pun. Anyway,
unintended. I mean, it is.
So you see from how he is able to drive really well in this kind of first getaway that he's a part of. Like, he's very skilled at driving, and I thought it was really cool how the song, or not the song, the before the song you get the baseball game, and that kind of acted as like a, it, with the scene, it was kind of like, you know, the game would get intense when you thought he was going to get caught.
Yeah. I thought that was done really well.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's like my favorite chase scene. It's a chase scene without necessarily a lot of squealing tires and crazy trip driving.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody who's very smart about driving where,
right,
where he knows he won't get found.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was a really neat way to do it.
And, he ends up using that as the way to evade people, is that, like, he drives the two robbers that he's helping to this to the baseball game and, like, disappears into the crowd with a baseball cap. And then you get the synth comes in, and it's all like, yo, meow,
meow, meow. Very, very retro music. I was like, when was this made again? You sure this was made in the 2000s? Because I think this is,
which is interesting that that's 2011, because now with Stranger Things,
and right, it's the, purposely, you know, set in the 80s.
Yeah,
like, this wasn't
like,
supposed to be set in the 80s.
You can
right?
barely watch like Banner Snatch.
Yeah.
You can barely watch anything without it being referenced to the 80s.
Right.
I think this was one of the first ones that kind of introduced that into the public consciousness again. Of like, synth music's pretty cool. then he meets Carey Mulligan in the elevator. You're just kind of like, hey, you know, like, you can see their chemistry just happening without them needing to say anything. I put car crash. Where is there a car crash?
Well, there wasn't. Her car overheats or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes her home.
Oh, right, right.
Well,
anyway.
Well, yeah, because then actually he takes her to the mechanic, and the mechanic, her, his boss guy,
uh-huh,
tries to hook them up.
Right. And so he helps her with her groceries. We get the setup with Shannon, who is his boss, who you mentioned. And he's trying to get money for Drive Dude. To Ryan Gosling's character to drive at like a legitimate
like a
race car. Yeah. And so he wants money for the race car. He gets offered $300,000 for 70% stake. And what was your opinion of the villains? Because I mean, it seems like they were sufficiently. Like, the acting in those scenes was, I think, pretty good. Like, I don't know, I don't remember if I've seen, I forget his name, but the guy that played, because you got Nino, who is Ron Perlman's character.
Right.
And then there's another actor. I'll look it up anyway.
I like the other actor better than Nino. Nino was very caricatured to me. I mean, he was supposed to be.
Mm.
But
yeah, it's very difficult to write ignorant characters.
Yeah,
because in one sense, like that, I thought that was an interesting thing with like a lot of these types of movies. You get different things broken down by race, and I think that they were kind of playing with that idea where there's like they're working with this Russian guy, and they're both Jews that I think work with an Italian syndicate or something.
I don't
like,
know who they were working for.
Right, because he blows up later about, like, being called a kike and, like, that being a chip on his shoulder in working for these people. Like, they called me that to my face. It's interesting because they, Shannon's played by Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston.
Yes.
Walter White's his character in Breaking Bad. And I think you get that. It's interesting because that kind of Walter White very much figures into that type of archetype that he plays, where he's like this very pitiful person that has is very still very charismatic,
mm-hmm,
and gets you to kind of like him, even though he's very obviously an over his head in a lot of these things. So that sets up that dynamic of like he's working with these people, but and it kind of sets up a theme. Albert Brooks, that's the he plays Bernie, who is the in between of him and Nino, and it's kind of setting up that Nino is this kind of like shady character who you're sure at some point is going to be much more revealed to be much more, you know, of a factor in the story than at first he lets on to be. But yes, you get the setup that Bryan Cranston's character, Shannon, is doesn't really know what he's getting himself into working with these people.
Well, no, but he should, because they reveal later how he was injured. So you'd think he'd have learned by now what this guy was like. But the fact that he is still working for that guy and still borrowing money from that guy, like, he's an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
He's a kind-hearted moron. It's what he is. Because he's very sweet and very nice to the people that, you know, the lady and to the driver and blah, blah, blah. But he's an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
I'm just like, he did what to you and you're still working with these people? Like, what is going on?
Bernie even says to Ryan Gosling's character, I got them mixed up because I feel like it sets up that kind of as a theme of like exploiting people, because Ryan Gosling's character, does he have a, you know, yeah, he's just called Driver.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says his name. So Driver brings Carey Mulligan's character to the shop to work on her car, and Shannon's talking to her and is saying, like, I've been exploiting him ever since because he came in and like, you know, I paid him like peanuts to work here.
Anyway.
And so it's an interesting thing that it sets up this like being willing to like do the bare minimum and like deal with some kind of like tough individual that's like gonna work you for all your worth as being a part of this kind of like masculine hierarchy.
Yeah.
That it's just a part of how this world works. But I think what you bring up is that Shannon is kind of like a foil for Driver, and that like his gullibility leads you to understand why in this universe Driver is as like removed and isolated as he is, because he feels like if the world sucks this much, I might as well, like, you know, be as like, you know, be regimented and be, you know, detached emotionally.
Do they ever explain why he's alone in the world?
No, it's very much that, like, kind of like with the Joker, kind of has that thing where, like, the part of the mystique of how did this character get to be this messed up is part of the whole package. But yeah, I don't remember there being anything that specifically said. Part of me like appreciates that it's not like, because when you just introduce something, like say first draft of this was very much like what they made in the movie. If there had been some producer that was like, well, give his mom cancer or something, just to make it like make some kind of sense. I feel like whatever you did, you know, wouldn't serve the character. I feel like it's trying to draw comparisons between how Shannon is and him, and it does enough, you know, with that stuff to kind of give you some idea about, like, this is a noir thing. This is, like, this gothic, almost, like, story where this is just how the world works kind of thing. But what do you think? Like, what... Do you think that there should have been something about, like, his family or something specifically that happened?
No, I was just, well, maybe. I mean, I was just curious if they ever explain it. I mean, I'm fine with, he's obviously meant to be symbolic of something more anonymous because they don't even give him a name. So I'm okay with that being how they decide to go with it. Like, you know, nothing about where he came from or where he's going or any of that stuff. He's just this drifter guy who's into cars. But it just would have been interesting. Like, it could have given a reason why he honors women the way he does, or why he's so detached from everything.
Right.
Because, like, he's, and kudos to Ryan Gosling for being able to make somebody unemotional look like they're still having lots of emotions. Like, I don't know how he did that, but it's not like.
Well, I called it the bogey effect.
Right.
Where, like, there's actors like him and, like, Benicio del Toro and, like, Sam Jackson or something that even when they're not given lines can just through a look communicate a lot.
A lot of stuff. And he was very unemotional in one sense, but also you could tell.
You could tell he was hiding emotions rather than
just not having any.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we should take a quick break for whatever ads you decide we're putting in the middle here, and we will be right back.
All right. Dennis Kane has a pretty average near-death experience. White light, crisis of faith, family bonding, don't forget delusions of grandeur. Plenty of those. After a surgery gone wrong leaves him bedridden, Dennis isn't satisfied with just regaining his strength. His harrowing journey of rehabilitation is just the beginning, as he seeks to cure his own muscle weakness, impress the girl of his dreams, and destroy his childhood bully. You know, your average delusions of grandeur. Experience the first chapter in a companion series based on the Seven Deadly Sins. Each tale will investigate the horrors of human error across history and contrasts our corruption with the power of the gospel. So we get the second meet cute type thing. Well, I guess this is the day. First of all, this was a debate on the Lost podcast that I listened to. Do you know what meet cute means?
I do know what meet cute means.
Okay. Because the one guy didn't, and the other two guys razzed on him for it for like 500 episodes.
Why would they razz on it? Like, is he a connoisseur of romances or something?
Because in LA, everybody is either an actor, a screenwriter, a director, or something.
Or wants to be.
So, like, the fact that you don't know every term for every screenwriting thing imaginable.
Oh.
It's kind of like a funny thing for, at least for them it was. But anyway, yeah, so they had their meet cute on the elevator. This is just like, hey, you want to see something cool? And he takes her on a drive. On that. I don't know what that's called, but there's this underpass where they film at, what is that? That Twilight, what is it called? They did it in that one scene in La La Land. Where they're dancing.
Oh, yeah.
There's that time of day where it's, like, perfect out. And that's when they do this drive. And you get this song that you said should have been in Blade Runner 2049.
Yes.
Because it's a...
Real human. There's several scenes in here that made me feel like it should have been
a real hero.
Human. Into a real human. It's not even real hero. It's into a real human.
Right.
Which was... I'm like, okay, so this is why they picked you for Blade Runner, because you can play this part.
You play Robot Whale. And so they have this, like, cute thing where he's like, she's like, I had a good time, and she's like, me too. Like this, you know, Han Solo-y, soft-spoken, sweet nothing. We go back to the garage where... Bernie. I keep forgetting that guy's name. Bernie, who is this go-between dude, this, like, loan shark, wise guy, is talking to Driver, and he kind of warns him, like, hey, I'm giving you all this money. You better, you know, do well. And he reveals that Nino was the one who got... Shannon injured. He broke his pelvis.
Yes.
And so that's when you're just like, Shannon has some problems if he's still talking to these people.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing because they're all talking about the car, and one of them says that the car is just a shell. It's the inside, not the outside, that counts. And that kind of, again, goes to the theme of this thing of, like, this, what it means to be an authentic human being and how you figure that into this masculine, you know, power fantasy thing. Again, it's evidence that they're aware of what they're, you know, dealing with in the thematic element of it. And then we get the bombshell that poor Carey Mulligan has a prison bait husband.
Yes.
I was interested when the credits were rolling in the beginning. You don't often get opening credit sequences anymore. And those were in that, like, Miami Vice font.
Yes.
So, again, you get that cool, like, you know, L.A.
He's noir kind of feel.
But I saw Oscar Isaac, and I'm like, I didn't know Oscar Isaac was in this movie. And that's who it is. She comes home and is toasting her and, like, you know, I love you for staying with me. And so I'll give it that credit, too, that in a lot of movies, when there is a character who is obviously not good enough for the love interest, and there's somebody else who's, like, more competent than him, there it's often very messy.
Yes.
And, like, we've kind of taken the rose-tinted glasses off now and looked back on some of those 80s movies and been like, just because that guy was a jerk on one date doesn't mean that you just leave him for Prince Charming. Like,
because, A, there are no Prince Charmings.
Yeah.
Because this guy wasn't Prince Charming either.
Mm, right.
And B, like, it's not how it works. It's not right. That easy.
Right. But yeah, it's showing you that this guy is, like, you know, has a heart, has feelings. He was, like, thinking of her this whole time. And we got kind of a good telling line of, like, how she feels without it being like you're just immediately going to leave this guy after he spent all this time in prison. She's like sitting outside the party because she doesn't like, it's kind of, there's this tension, you don't know what it's from, but Driver's out there in the hallway and she's like, I wish, like, he's like, I was going to call the cops as a joke because it's like, it's about the noise or whatever. And she's like, I wish you would. And so you get this idea that, like, she at least hasn't forgiven him yet, or that there's something about his character that's deeper than just, like, some, you know, mistake that he made, something that he got mixed up in. And pretty quickly, he is found by Driver bleeding somewhere, and he brings him back to his apartment. It's like, who are they? And he's like, yeah, I paid these people for protection in prison. And they just started saying, like, oh, you know, we said it was 5,000. Turns out it was, like, 10,000. You know, how about 20,000? And so you got the idea that, like, he's making a lot of decisions that are getting him in with some crazy people. And so you get this kind of thing of, like, you know, he's this cool driver dude. And it gets in with this single mom, and he gives the son this there's an interesting scene because one of the bad guys that beat up Standard is Oscar Isaac's character's name, gives him a bullet, and, you know, he's like, you know, why don't you give that to me? So there's
the bad guys give him the bullet, and it wasn't his dad.
No, yeah. That's what I'm, yeah, if that didn't go across, that's what I meant. And so the son gives it to Driver, and he's like, why don't I keep it? So is there anything at this point in the story that is like shouting in your brain as like, there's something weird going on, or are you along, I can't get away from this stupid metaphor, along with the ride?
Well, no, because that's when I start to, like, because at first I wasn't sure if he was going to try and run with the girl. Or, like, and, like, you know, turn the guy in, because there were plenty of reasons he could have.
Right.
Or if he was going to try and help the situation. And once he talks the way he does to the kid, you realize, oh, okay, he's going to help them.
Right.
Even though he probably hates this guy and the guy is an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, whatever, I need to save this family. They are together and they should be together, so I'm going to go take care of this.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I'm trying to find where this, there's a particular moment where he goes into a, he goes into a, I feel like part of the, this kind of like, you begin to see that there's a different side to this person and what makes you kind of think about like, they're because one thing I think that this film is kind of dealing with is that there's this inherent power fantasy in the male subconscious. And like, I've had dreams of, you know, there being some kind of shootout and then I sacrifice myself. It's a weird part of the back of your brain as a guy that you do some, there's this moment of thing where you sacrifice everything and everybody loves you. Right. And so what I think that a lot of these modern action movies are trying to challenge is that the white knight thing of just because this person is willing to die, that they're everything, every choice that they're making is now like, it's kind of like with the we watched Invasion of the Body Snatchers for a late podcast right now. It's kind of laying dormant. But regardless, it was in this 50s, this time where this guy, just because he's a doctor, nobody questions anything he says. Everybody in town knows him and likes him. And he can tell people to drink and pop pills at any given moment. Right. And that's automatically
and
good
it's
because
all fine.
He's a doctor.
Yeah.
So, so like this idea of like, I was trying to kind of be as objective as possible, especially because he's white and Oscar Isaac, regardless of, I don't know what race he is, because I feel like he's played a lot of them. You know, him being this white knight that saves him from the darkie that was in jail. It's like, I was like, please don't do this movie. There's a scene where he's in a diner and you can tell that he's pissed off that this girl that he met that's very nice and has this cute son and that she's been vibing with is, like, married. So there's a guy that's like, oh, I know you, like, you did a job for me. And he's like, if you talk to me again in public or whatever, I'm going to bash your teeth down your throat or something. So you start getting, like, there's a lot of rage in this character. Yeah. And that there's a difference between a hero who is willing to do what it takes to do the right thing and is constantly trying to search for what the right thing is versus somebody who is so nihilistic.
Well, it's just the goal he has in trying to keep the family safe is a good thing. It's mm-hmm. just what happens is rather than him becoming a hero and trying to find out what's right and the best way to handle it, he just gets triggered. Like, that's how it feels. Like, mm-hmm. something switches,
right.
And he's just like, screw this, we're killing all of them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's over.
Right. And which, to your point, would be a positive reason for there to be a something that you know from his past.
Yeah, like a trauma or something that he went through where mm-hmm. it's not just, oh, I'm gonna, you know, flip a switch and lose it on everybody, because up until this point he's been very, very reserved and very unemotional, like hiding his emotions on purpose. And then all of a sudden now he's just like, nope, I'm letting it go and we're done. I'm like, what happened to you, buddy? Because something obviously happened to you
right.
somewhere back there.
Because if anything, that this new era of social consciousness has been challenging the idea of the white man with a gun is going to solve everything. And if you, without nuance, present a hero who has no reason for being this violent, and because he's this violent, he saves the day. it's kind of something that you can't really get away with nowadays. There has to be, like, for example, you guys went to see the there's a 70s exploitation movie that Bruce Willis did a reboot.
Oh, the Death Wish.
Right. And so back in the day, Charles Bronson was just the dude that took care of stuff. And nowadays, with so many examples of people with guns shooting up, you know, whatever, in mass.
Any place that ticked them off, apparently.
It's the laundry list of, like, hate crimes and corrupt police doing stuff. Like, it's an image that evokes now more chaos than order.
Right.
And so that's one thing that I'll criticize about the movie, is that if it had something to latch onto from his past, and you don't even have to, because one thing that's positive about this is that I feel like a guy that's this messed up isn't going to open up suddenly to some character. Like, I feel like maybe if he was with this girl for 5 years, maybe 5 years down the line, he'll be like, so yeah, my mother got murdered in front of me.
Yeah, like, you know,
but
something like that. It's, but he's not going to say it now.
But maybe something like if flashbacks. Shannon had, through his connections, maybe found out that this guy's parents had been murdered or something like that, then through that, we could have seen some kind of logic to this, other than because he is competent, then he gets the gun and gets to, you know, do everything. As you said, like, he's not automatically, there are some steps that it takes before it's not like Death Wish, really.
Yes.
There are some things that happen. So he decides, rather than, you know, even though you get that moment of anger in the diner, he decides, I'm going to help out Standard and try to get him the money to pay back this thing. But it goes horribly wrong, and you get that, like, it was all just a setup to get money for this debt that Nino has. And some of the storytelling things there are a little bit confusing, because, like, it's one of those movies, unlike something like Death Wish, where it's trying to get you to do the work to make some connections. You know, the driver knows right away that it's a setup because there's another car, and, you know, when they're making the robbery. And, you know, for a second, you think that this girl that Christina Hendricks plays is maybe the one that's, like, that part of the setup. And he's going to, like, beat her up to try to get some information. But then it turns out that Nino sent some guys over. There's some more violence where she gets
really
her head blown off.
Violence. It was pretty gross.
You get a little bit of brooding. Shannon is just like, you're crazy for even trying to help this guy out. Then you get this, like, really tense scene where he brings the a hammer to this strip club and goes into the changing room.
That I thought was well done.
Yeah, because that
and him threatening the girl when he wanted to like get the information out of her. Those are both very well done tense scenes.
Yeah, I think it consistently through that each time shows this rage that he has bottled up, but also he's trying to do the thing that gets Carey Mulligan and her son to safety.
I think a lot of the bad guys assume, because he works with Shannon and because he's just a driver, that he's not their level criminal or that he's not dangerous. And through that whole thing, he proves, no, I've just been being nice. You have no idea what I can do to you guys. Right. And I don't care. Because he literally has no stake at all for himself. Like, he's like, I got nothing to lose. So if I want to, you know, destroy the world.
And I think that's what brings to my mind nihilism, because it's this idea of, you get this somewhat, and we might talk about this with Watchmen, because Rorschach is a very nihilist, heroic character. And it's very interesting because it's framing it in such a way that, like, if I'm going to impose meaning onto this meaningless life. It's a very weird circular thing that I don't know if I would say that I philosophically agree with, but like there is that weird feeling of like, I have this despair and I finally met somebody that I have some kind of connection with. And it's like hanging on the edge of a knife. And if one thing twists the wrong way, like, I'm just going to mow everybody down. Like, mm-hmm. There's this, like, abandon to the character that's really potent throughout all these, like, different tense scenes. And so he gets a time and a place to meet with Bernie to make the final, like, he still has the money, so, like, I want to make an exchange. And he, like, goes to Carey Mulligan and is like, you know, you can have the money if you want. She slaps him.
Yeah.
And I feel like that gave her some agency in terms of showing that she realizes that, like, he wanted to help, but that, you know, all the, like, it shows that she has some emotions other than, like, oh, great, a knight well, shining armor to her here
was,
to rescue me.
It was, I found this cool guy. And my dumb husband's back, and my husband's being dumb, and then
At that point, her husband's dead. Right.
Well, yeah, but then, wait, this guy I thought that was a nice guy is a psychopath, which she discovers in the elevator.
Right.
And she's like, she's probably like, I'm done with men now, really. Mm-hmm. But just the idea of like, nope. Like, she actually still had the choice of like, you can save me if you want to, but I'm out of here.
Right, and so it's an interesting thing because we do get this very, like, classic, like, this is straight up noir in the elevator. They get in, and they have this, I didn't look it up, but there's this, like, spotlight on them.
Right.
And in some of these noir things, you do get these, like, unnaturalistic
lighting
focuses with light. And so you get that where he kisses her because the next thing he does is kick a person's face in. Literally. Who's on the elevator with them trying to, you know,
kill her.
Him or her, or both her, of them. And so this is where you had the line, I have to drive because I can't cry.
Yes. That's totally what's happening in those scenes. Several scenes where he's just brooding in the car.
Right.
And it's that's also a very noir kind of, you know, modern masculine hero moment where I can't cry, so this is what I do.
Right. And I found when I was writing in high school and stuff that I often resorted to just having crying be the signet of emotion. And I can understand, like, that being a critique of a script where if, like, you don't know how to you don't know how this character yet shows emotion. And without thinking about that, you just put crying. But at the same time, I was telling you that was part of the Greg Capullo run on Batman, where he's like, you can't have Batman cry, so I'm going to have water dripping on him, and you get the emotion of this. But it seems to me that it's very odd that, like, they can't, like, I feel like a good positive example of this is in spoiler alert for Hell or High Water. There's these two guys who I'm gonna cry just thinking about it. There are these two partners who throughout the whole movie are chasing the bank robbers, and they have this really, like, simple relationship. Like, they make fun of each other, and, you know, it's seemingly innocuous little banter scenes back and forth. And then the one partner gets shot, and Jeff Bridges, who's the one that survives, has this, like, it's just a second of, like, tears just bursting out. And it's a brilliant scene of, like, how a guy who's like, I'm in a firefight right now is trying to bottle all this emotion up. And yet it just something has to come out because right. he loves this guy.
Right.
So like those types of things where, you know, if you're going to show that this person is dealing with some emotion, you can have them cry and do that in a way that is befitting of the scene and befitting of the character. And some of those tropes of just sitting there staring in the car can come across as like, you know, I've seen this type of thing, but now it's kind of the pendulum has swung to like, this is becoming more cliche than the other thing. What mom thought was the, kind of funny thing was that he gets blood on his scorpion jacket and then for the rest of the movie never doesn't changes change out it. Of it.
Like at the first I thought it was like, okay, well he's on the movie set where he works, so nobody's gonna say anything about a bloody jacket on a movie set when you're the stunt driver. Like right. you might just look like you got right. fake blood on
you. And you might not want them to call their union.
Yeah.
And like get on you about bleeding, so you're just like, yeah,
whatever, it's fine. He'll walk it off. But the other scene where he's just like randomly, where does he go to like the super? Where does he go? I don't even know. But he goes somewhere public, and you're just like, dude, nobody's gonna say anything. Like, I mean, I know this is LA and all, but really?
Well, he goes to get the mask.
Oh right.
Or the
well, that's what he goes to the movie set for. Face. He goes to the rubber, get the rubber face yeah. thing.
Because it sets up before that he wears the scout. You know, he wears.
He's a stunt double, like the, so he, you know he has to look like the main character,
the lead character. We get a line from Albert Brooks' character Bernie again that like all of this stuff is just bad luck. He's talking to Shannon. He's like, you know, I hate to do this, but I'm gonna kill you and kill you for a graphic, disturbing way. And so that to me is this kind of it's an invocation of this kind of what academics have called bad faith. I forget who coined the term. But it's this idea of like, I have a moral code. I have this system where it's like, okay, you're an idiot. You need to die. And that seems to be what Bernie kind of represents. Whereas like Nino is very like animalistic.
Yeah,
and more
Nino's
just like,
pure evil.
Yeah, like there's not really much nuance to him.
Right.
Bernie is more like this like middle manager
right.
guy. Who's like,
I didn't really want to have to do this, but if I have to,
yeah,
for business reasons, then I will.
Right. And then you got this scene with Driver in the mask looking in on all this revelry of Bernie at this at the Chinese place. And he is like looking in the window and the song Oh My Love starts playing.
Right. Which is really weird.
Yeah. And so that to me is another like kind of cliche thing of like a very beautiful song in a very, what's going to be a very violent scene.
Yeah.
That's going to happen.
The one that I thought noticed at first was Face Off when the mom puts headphones on John the little Woo. Kid. So he's listening to Somewhere Over the Rainbow while there's this humongous firefight happening all around. But you don't hear the guns. You right. just hear the music and watch right. this kid crawl through this like massive gunfight.
So what I'll say is that the soundtrack of this film is amazing.
Yes.
But
strange,
those types of things are a little bit distracting, especially because there is some tension about like I was saying, you don't know whether this guy is just going to murder everyone in this whole crime family.
Right.
Or if he's going to be like his character would, you would assume based on how it's built up, the tension, that he's going to do something that is not necessarily the moral thing, but is the right thing in this situation. Like you're going to feel good about what he did in some ways. So there's going to be some cathartic feeling. There's this kind of beachside thing where he, this is when he gets Nino and he like drowns him in the ocean. And then he calls Bernie up, and it's just like, you know, and then this is where we get a very classic symbol of the snake and the frog. Not the snake and the frog. The frog and the scorpion. Where the scorpion asks the frog to cross the river, and
the scorpion kills him anyway.
Yeah, and he's just like,
and the
I'm
frog's
a scorpion.
Like, why would you do that? So, I'm a scorpion. That's what I do.
Right. And so it's pretty obvious with him having a scorpion
jacket
that, like you were saying, there's this theme of people underestimating his ability, and the kind of dual meaning of that parable being that, like, in this universe, people don't change. There's not really that
kind of,
like, growth for him. But the fact that he, you know, like, they underestimated him means that when he meets Bernie, he takes him out. And there's this kind of ambiguous thing where he is able to get up and start driving, but you don't know because...
Because he's bleeding from this, you know, because Bernie stabs him back. Mm-hmm. You don't know if he's actually going to survive.
Right, and Carey Mulligan's character seems to think, like, okay, I woke up after trying to avoid the world. Like, you know, maybe everything's all right. She goes to check his room, but he's not there. And that's when you get the scene at the end with the on the open road. So I guess my closing thoughts would be that there are a lot of interesting visual things. Like I said, the soundtrack's really cool. And I tend to support the whole idea of, like, if you're going to have violence in something, it's good for the young minds out there that are watching Cinemax at 3 a.m. when they should be going to sleep. Like, they should understand that violence has consequences. And, like, there should be kind of a little bit of both. You want there to be male characters like Superman who, like, are always there and then a good time and show, you know, like, you know, truth, justice in the American way, all that stuff. But it's also, I think, good to show in these types of situations where, like, there are really criminals out there that think that violence is the answer.
Yes.
And this is all the things that come from, you know, that kind of lifestyle. So what are your closing thoughts?
So I liked that it was somewhat noir. I think the characters were very noir-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the storyline wasn't necessarily a very common noir kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I could have done without the hyper-realistic violence because
mm-hmm.
that was really gross. Mm-hmm. There were many parts I just covered my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do I. And I don't normally do that.
But, I mean, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was well done. I think the acting helped a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little higher artsy than I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Most noir stuff isn't that high artsy kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more pulpy adventure kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's more or less what it seems to be like in this age of comic book films that are the predominant thing. I think that the directors like M. Night Shyamalan, we talked about with the last, you know, episode on Glass, and Nicholas Winding Refn choosing to take crime, because it seems, I feel like he did this one, and I think he did Only God Forgives, which is another one that's more Asian influenced stuff, still, you know, super hyper violent, it's very interesting because in one sense, like, I don't know that I could produce something that has that level of graphic. I'm comfortable with writing it on the page.
Yeah, but seeing it is a different thing.
Seeing it is, yeah, and it's I feel the same way about, like, The Walking Dead. I don't watch The Walking Dead show, but something about having it in print makes a little bit more, I have a little bit more removal from it. That aspect of the movie, it also, like, disturbed me greatly. At the same time, like, I do appreciate the fact that there are crime films that aren't apologetic about showing you what violence is really like. And, you know, that there's, I think that there is a place for that within the genre. I just don't know that I'm going to watch it every day. Thanks for listening to our episode about Drive and about Neon Noir. I personally write thrillers, and so if you want to check out my first book, Cain and Abel, CaneAble, on Amazon, you can look that up. And things and stuff.
Things and stuff.
You can also email us at unboxingstorypodcast@gmail.com. We're at Unboxing Story on Facebook and Twitter. I am at John Matos Writer on Instagram and Twitter. And I think on Facebook.
Yes. And you can find my writings at momtoast.com. And I am momtoast on Instagram and momtoast_Mel on Twitter.
All right. Thanks again. And we'll talk to you later.
Bye.